This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia.
One of the things about CTE too is that it's not an old person's disease. It's not found just in people who are 60 or 70 years of age, but we've found CTE in athletes as young as 17 and in Australia as young as 20 years of age. The responsibility lies with these codes. They are tax-free charities. They are posting and boasting huge surpluses every year. Yet what we see is the aftermath of the workers, who are the players themselves, with debilitating ongoing injuries.
Concussion and brain damage in sport isn't just a crisis, it's claiming lives. Neurophysiologist and Swinburne University researcher Professor Alan Pearce says we need to stop calling this a mental health issue and start addressing it for what it is, brain disease. More specifically, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. His research, along with global studies, shows it's not just diagnosed concussions that matter, it's the years of smaller, repeated knocks that quietly add up to this lifelong damage. As violent trends like run it straight and unofficial backyard boxing go viral, he warns that we're normalising brain trauma for the next generation, and not everyone's willing to face these facts. In fact, he's copped enormous backlash for this principled and informed public position he's taken. In a piece he wrote for the online site The Conversation, he says he is not anti-sport, he's pro-athlete, and if you love sport, you should be too.
Been doing this research now for about 16 years, and I guess where this article came from is that we've made so much progress, but at the same time we've plateaued and in some respects have regressed, given what we now know about the dangers of concussion, the short and long-term effects, but also the effects of, I guess, the long-term ramifications, which we now know about, called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. And so while there has been some progress in management of concussion and what we should be doing with returning to play for sports like rugby and football and soccer, we are still seeing this sort of pushback, and particularly with activities, which I'll call rather, it's not necessarily a sport, but activities like run it and even power slap, where it's just a blatant, almost in your face pushback that people can say, we're going to do this anyway and we don't care about our brain health. And I just find that really astonishing.
Some people have put it down to this manosphere, this rise in forms of masculinity that promote really violent ways of being in public spaces and being in sport. Mm-hmm. But you've been studying this and researching this and talking and lecturing on this very issue for so long. At what point did you notice that this is where these events were headed? What were some of those early warning signs for you throughout your career where you had to start speaking up more?
For me, well, early on, it was one of those things where I thought, well, okay, I've always had an interest in brain injury, and for me, it was a little bit serendipitous to come into the concussion space. And that's a whole different story on its own. But in short, it was really quite surprising to me, because I would have expected some concerns around concussion, but I never expected the almost avalanche of concerns from retired athletes and long-term people who've been playing for a long time saying that I've got problems that I never expected and I didn't even realize until I heard you speak up. So for me, that was really quite, I guess, concerning that we've got a potential time bomb here in terms of not just the elite players, but people who do activities at club level and things like that, having the same problems. And so we've made some real progress, but over the last couple of years, I've done some real pushback in terms of people actually using it as a badge of honour. You might have seen the recent story of Victor Radley holding up a T-shirt, almost boasting about the 38 concussions that he's had over his career, alongside how many beers he's drunk, and using that as how tough he is, and talking to that sort of extreme masculine approach on what it is to be a man. And to be a man is to be able to tolerate and take on a lot of things that actually can be quite damaging. And for me, that was a bit of a warning sign that we're starting to see that. And down here in Melbourne too, there have been a number of Australian football players pushing medics away when they're obviously concussed, saying, I'm fine, don't come and try and treat me, don't tell me to come off because I'm tougher than that. And this whole round of toughness is almost starting to rise up again. And that's my concern, because what I see in the lab are the after effects, where people have gone, why did I do this? Why was I so stupid? And I've got my whole life ahead of me, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to enjoy it or not. And that's, for me, what people don't see.
That shirt, that Victor Radley shirt incident, where he proudly stood with a shirt made to highlight all the things in his career, including the number of concussions, was posted on the club's social media page and then taken down. And in this article recently, you've said you've spoken to the apathy, or even there is like an active opposition to this kind of criticism, where it's usually responded to with some type of generic statement. What have been your own dealings with codes that have had to do things like take down posts, where they've obviously recognised that it's tone deaf, but perhaps they haven't gone so far as to realise that they're not doing enough?
I'm not exactly the code's favourite person, to be completely blunt. And the reason for that is that I do speak up, and I'll speak up publicly to try and create awareness around this. And to a certain extent, I'm also, I guess, pushed aside, or I'm not sure what the right word is, targeted as well by other colleagues. This is not just a pushback from sport, but this is also a pushback from a number of colleagues in peers in academic circles as well, who do have funding and collaborations with these sports. And I am accused of sensationalizing this issue. I'm accused of being anti-sport. I'm accused of being almost a woke scientist to an extent as well. So I cop a lot of criticisms for speaking up, as well as being a media tart and wanting attention. And it's not anything about that other than just trying to raise awareness around the fact that we've got an issue that we have to address, and we can't just cover it up under the guise that sport is good for you, and sport is great for you. It has so many benefits. We do have to make sport safe as well, and we can't just let sport become a vehicle for accepted violence, for example. So we have to be staying aware and conscious about that. And just in relation to the comment that you know, the quote that you put in there, is this is one of the reasons why I'm trying to also talk about this, is because we're confusing CTE with concussion issues. And while concussion has a contribution towards CTE risk, what we now know is that CTE is around exposure risk of repetitive impacts. So it's not just about the one or two or 10 concussions or 39 concussions that someone might have, but rather the 10, 20 or 30,000 hits over a career. But whenever I'm involved with the Australian Sports Brain Bank, when the Australian Sports Brain Bank releases data on a player who's been diagnosed with CTE, the response is being what you just said, where the sport will try and turn it back into a concussion issue. Whereas we're not talking about concussion, we're talking about exposure to repetitive impacts. And that's what we're trying to address here.
On Pacific Pulse, my guest is Professor Adjunct Research Fellow in the School of Health Science, Dr. Professor Alan Pearce, who is a neuroscientist. We're talking about CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is different to concussion because it talks about the repeated nature of a head injury, and it doesn't often result, or don't have to be knocked out for people to later be diagnosed with CTE. You've gone into some of the solutions that you've proposed, really, and this is, I think, why you do such important work, because, yes, all of these institutions need to be held to account, but they also need to have solutions and to be steered into that direction. So you've developed a framework for how to respond to CTE. Are you able to talk about this prevention protocol, the ways that you think you can modify people's behaviour?
Yeah, that's right. So we have been getting emerging evidence around the exposure risk. And so as part of getting people to understand that people who don't have to be concussed can be at risk of CTE. Myself and colleagues at the Brain Bank and colleagues in the UK and the USA through the Concussion Legacy Foundation have produced a CTE prevention protocol. Now, we have to, unlike Alzheimer's, where we really don't know what is the mechanism for cause of Alzheimer's. We know how what happens, but we don't really know why people get Alzheimer's. CTE as a dementia, we know that it's related to impacts to the brain, traumatic impacts to the brain. So with the CTE prevention protocol, we've been working on trying to get people to understand that we've got to reduce the risk. And the ways that we can do that is by reducing the contact in training, having smarter training sessions rather than just having traditional hard hitting training sessions and punishing training sessions, reducing that risk, working on skills, working on tactics, strategies, rather than just the bash and crash training session. We want to look at recovery periods after a concussion, obviously, because then it reduces that amount of exposure that can be risky for what we call second impact syndrome. But probably one of the most controversial, I guess, suggestions that we're trying to get people to understand is to reduce that exposure risk by modifying sports for children and young adolescents, and not banning sport, but just modifying the and taking out the contact until the age of 14 years of age. We know that this can reduce the risk of CTE by 6 to 8 years, which can be quite significant. And one of the things about CTE too is that it's not an old person's disease. It's not found just in people who are 60 or 70 years of age, but we've found CTE in athletes as young as 17 and in Australia as young as 20 years of age. So CTE is developing in the brain while someone is still playing in their career. And so we've got to reduce that risk. And so what we want to do is that we have no contact in children and young adolescents. They can still learn how to run, all the fundamental motor skills, running, jumping, passing, kicking, throwing, catching, resilience with psychological resilience by dealing with teammates, dealing with winning and losing, how to work in a group. And then as they get closer to 14, start to teach them the skills of tackling in a controlled environment so that we're still reducing that risk of impacts to the brain. So one of the things that we're trying to do is get people to get their heads around that, so to speak, to understand that they can still have their sport. We just want to make it safer and we want to reduce that risk so that we don't have these tragic events of people passing away young with a brain disease that we could have prevented.
I think, like you say, developing the language for CTE rather than concussion will go some way into thinking about how do we keep our kids safe, and they can still excel after the age of 14. It doesn't in any way change that.
Oh, absolutely. And we see time and time again examples of players, people who are champion premiership players, starting at 15 or 16 years of age, and people think that they have to start at 6 or 7. Yeah, we do need to change this conversation.
With the development of the Women's League, a lot of the players that are playing now, I grew up playing touch football with here in Australia, and so they were poached out of touch football, rugby sevens, different codes, especially less contact sports, and taken into these codes and developed as adult athletes. It wasn't something that they needed to be doing from the age of 5, and it just shows just how willing sport agencies are to poach players from different codes because of the skills that they have. So yes, it's really right. Good to highlight that you're not taking away.
No, not at all. That's right. And it's interesting when you're suggesting that touch football is a pathway for going into the full game. People have looked at me like I've got 3 heads. Oh, you're going to ruin the fabric of the game. And it's no, we're not. We're actually introducing them to a modified form that they can then graduate to a full level. So many other sports have modified forms of their tennis, for example. We wouldn't put a kid of 7 or 8 with a full size tennis racket now because we know that there could be chronic shoulder problems. We don't have kids. Sorry, I should say limitations on kids on the number of bowling they do in cricket or pitching in baseball, again, for concerns around chronic shoulder or knee problems. Yet we seem to accept that it's okay to have kids being hit in the head. because we don't want to ruin the fabric of the game. And so I find that's quite illogical in some respects.
And so I guess what you've left us on is that many people have turned around and said to you, don't politicize this issue, stop turning it into a moment for yourself or for politics, keep sport sport. There are now podcasts that are created by people to raise awareness and to hopefully end violence against women, which stems from rugby league culture. We've got to a point where these have become political issues because the NRL hasn't had a fantastic track record on how it treats themselves and the respect for themselves and their families and their partners. And that's something that has been spoken about. So I think it's definitely, I don't think it's valid to say that you can't politicize CTE. And would you turn around and say that to Wally Lewis, who is now one of the most well-known CTE advocates for Dementia Australia? But like you said, you've been told not to politicize this issue, but it does need to be spoken about. And even if there's no political will, you've said that families deserve to be aware of what these risks are. So I guess, who do you think this burden falls on to hold this torch and to spread the awareness and change sports to make them safer?
The responsibility lies with these codes. They are tax-free charities. They are hosting and boasting huge surpluses every year. Yet what we see is the aftermath of the workers, who are the players themselves, with debilitating ongoing injuries. Certainly here in Melbourne in the AFL, there is no workers' compensation for AFL athletes. They have to rely on insurance payouts, possibly, and this is why there is a class action, because many are left with debilitating injuries and cognitive problems that as a result of their participation in these sports. So in some respects, it is a political issue, and the sports themselves have to, as they control the way that their organisations are, that they control the level of sport, they control their sport at every level, from grassroots through to the professional leagues. So there has to be more done in this space to not just educate. Ticking the box to say that we've had an education session really, in my opinion, has no effect at all, because it's about culture change. And as you talked about, violence against women and men also trying to take responsibility for themselves. And this is all talking to the larger cultural issue around this. So if we can start to try and show that impacts to the head is not accepted, that we have to modify our sports, we have to protect the brain. Physical impacts to the brain is not something that we will tolerate anymore. More than just, oh, look, the health and well-being of our players is our greater priority, yet we're quite happy to see advertising that shows these incredibly violent collisions and tackles. And it just says to me that they're not doing enough in this space. And As I have said throughout this interview, we have family support meetings for those who've lost loved ones for CTE, and there is not one family who is not in tears that are grieving their loved one, whether it's their father who passed away with dementia at 70 or 65, or whether it was their son who died at 30 years of age, or their brother, whoever, even their sisters now, because we're starting to see female athletes with CTE as well. It is one of those things that people don't see, and this is why we have to keep talking about this publicly.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for the work that you do doing that. Just finally, our audiences are Pacific-based, but as we spoke about at the start, the Run It Straight contests emerged from the diaspora community in Australia and was exported overseas, and we still see that being carried out in places internationally today with really dangerous consequences and people being actually concussed. Who knows what their CTE risk is? But for families in the Pacific, there's no infrastructure to respond to any of these injuries if they happen to have them over there. What might just be your final message to anyone who is considering maybe getting their children into sport or is watching them undertake, risky behaviour?
One of the things that particularly with Run It, but I've been quite vocal about is, yeah, look, it's been developed from the schoolyard or the park game where you've got one person with the ball, the other person's trying to stop them and trying to stop them to get to the end, and no necessarily any arguments around that. But what the concern around Run It is that we've been taking an element of that and supercharging it into a pure collision event. So what you don't have anymore is that when the ball carrier and the tackler come in, they slow up and then go into it. A tackle that you would see in rugby, which is safer and guided by rules that you don't go too high and you don't try and aim for the head. But what we're seeing now with Run It is that people are just resorting back to the collision and actually trying to take each other out. And this is what we've seen with, you know, some of these viral videos and unfortunately the death in New Zealand about a month and a half back now. And so the concern that I've had is that people might look at this and look at the prize money, think it's an easy way of winning some money, but at what cost? And particularly that they're taking out the elements of the safety of slowing up and tackling and just colliding against each other. And so for me, it's if you're thinking about putting your kids in sport and team sports or anything like that, contact sports, is go to rugby and have the coaches teach the proper skills, teach safety, teach hopefully a touch version of that so they can still get the physical activity that we want and all the associated sociological and psychological benefits of that. But don't just get seduced by the whole Run It craze because it looks exciting. And I'm still concerned that there's going to be deaths in the professional leagues because you only need an older teenager, 18 or 19 or 20, having multiple concussive events and risking second impact syndrome. And it doesn't matter if there's a medical team there or not. Second impact syndrome can cause death within minutes. Mm. And so that's the real worry that I have. And I just hope that I'm proven wrong and there's no further deaths from Run It because that's my big fear right now.
Yeah, me too. I hope so too. Just finally, I just wanted to ask if you could explain the second impact syndrome, because this is a really important thing that you do for work. And yeah, if you could maybe explain it a bit of in layman's terms maybe for us.
Yeah, sure. Second impact syndrome is a rare event. And I say rare because in sports like rugby and football, you don't get a lot of collisions that are this sort of violent that quickly. But with second impact syndrome, what it is that you have an impact to the brain that sets off, I guess, setting off a whole bunch of molecules in the brain. The brain is in a state of trauma. A lot of blood flow drops, molecules are released. The brain is working extra hard to continue. And then you set off a second impact in a short period of time. Now, short period of time could be anywhere after a couple of minutes to half an hour to even the next day. That then sets a catastrophic chain of events that then leads to brain swelling and death in very quickly within minutes because there's nothing you can do apart from surgical intervention, which is not possible within minutes, to reduce that pressure. And unfortunately, we've seen around the world, young men and women and boys and girls die because of second impact syndrome. And this is why Run It is a concern, because you are getting guys running at each other 4 to 6 times in a short period of window. And that's why I'm very worried about second impact syndrome.
That was neurophysiologist Professor Alan Pearce from Swinburne University speaking about concussion, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and the urgent need for change in contact sports. If you missed any part of this episode, just search for us, Pacific Pulse, on the ABC Pacific website or your favourite podcasting app. This episode was produced on the lands of the Yuggera and the Turrbal people.
Talofalava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.